that a scholar in Israel who has spent virtually a long part of his life studying it. Am I right?
30 years.
30 years. We expect to be talking about some very exciting topics on prophecy. But first of all, let's ask Bendel Jones where he came from, what he's doing, what he has done in the past. It's been a very exciting life that you've been leading.
Are you a Baptist minister from Texas?
Yes, I was born and reared in Sudan, Texas, on the Panhandle, and pastored for 11 years on the East Coast in Tennessee and North Carolina before I went into Jewish studies. And in 1956, I began Jewish studies to 1959.
Now, you speak Hebrew.
I get by in Hebrew. I know how to eat and work and study the Bible. That's enough.
Now, you've lived over there for a while.
I lived in Israel for over 4 years altogether, and I'm back an average of about 6 months out of every 18 months I spend there.
Now, you studied with the Kabbalists?
Yes, I studied at Hebrew University in the Department of Judaica after spending 3.5 years in study in this country in a synagogue with a rabbi. I studied at Hebrew University, Midrash HaGadah, the Hamish Megillot, and the basic Jewish studies. And then I had a very unusual privilege as a non-Jew. I was invited to study with Chaim Shavili, who was then the leading Kabbalist in Jerusalem in Beit HaKabbalah. The Kabbalah is the mystical level of rabbinic interpretation. I studied 2 years with Chaim Shavili, and almost 2 years at the Lubavitcher Chabad Yeshiva, which is one of the Hasidic groups, and I was permitted to sit in class and to listen to the rabbinic arguments and discussions concerning rabbinic interpretation, the Sefer Tanya, the Midrash, the Mishnah Gomorrah, the various levels of rabbinic interpretation.
We wanted to get to that subject, which is so important these days, with regards to the, it's the importance of Jerusalem as a city. In 1967, now you were there and you participated in that Six-Day War.
That's right.
They captured the old city of Jerusalem. Is that significant?
Very significant from the standpoint of Bible prophecy. Both in Judaism and in the New Testament, Jesus spoke of this particular event, because Jerusalem, after the reign of Solomon, king of Israel, 25 centuries ago, had never been the capital of United Israel in all those centuries until June 1967.
Now, of course, that's important to the Jews simply because of the Temple Mount that's there. But now you have the Mosque of Omar that's on it. How is all that going to be resolved? Do you have any idea on that?
Well, there's been more heat than light on that subject. The book of Ezekiel describes the future temple of Jerusalem and the future city of Jerusalem. Amazingly, the city that Ezekiel described in chapters 40 through 46 did not meet the description of historic Jerusalem or Jerusalem of the first or second temple period. But it's amazing how it fits Jerusalem today, the description of Ezekiel.
The size of it? And
the size and everything of that Ezekiel saw fits the description today where it did not fit the first or second temple period of Jerusalem. In fact, the book of Ezekiel almost was left out of the canon because what he saw did not fit historically what was there.
Did you feel at the time of the 67 war that if the old city of Jerusalem was captured, that that would be the beginning of the end of the Gentile period?
Yes, as a matter of fact, there was something very interesting that happened in 1967 and in 1917. You know, Ezekiel makes quite a record, so to speak, about the Eastern Gate not being opened, and Hussein was going to build a hotel on the west side of the temple area, a big hotel, and the western wall, the Wailing Wall, was going to be used as the eastern wall of the Grand Ballroom. And it was Hussein that took the refugees out of the old Jewish quarter and bulldozed all of it down. It was not the Jews. He had evacuated the refugees and put them in Jericho, and the Jordanians had bulldozed all that down to build this hotel. And he had ordered the eastern gate to be opened before they closed that side for the building of the hotel. Now, the interesting thing, that is the second time in this in our generation that order has been given. The first time was in 1917. The second time, 1967. Now, how much?
You were talking about the Golden Gate on the eastern
side. That's right, the Golden Gate on the eastern side. The eastern gate, the Mount of Olives, the one that Ezekiel said was closed would not be open.
Now, that was closed back
by the Turks. The previous gates were not closed. The previous gates of Jerusalem were open. There is a gate under that gate that was open during the Second Temple period. That gate was open. During the Byzantine and Crusader period, there was not a gate there at all. And then Shulamun the Great built a gate over the old gate under on the east side in front of the temple area.
No, right.
That
there
gate was closed.
Right by the wall there. That's there's right. a cemetery, Muslim cemetery, isn't it?
For the same reason the gate is closed. The Muslim closed the gate to keep the Jewish Messiah from coming through, because the Jews believe the Messiah will come through that gate going to Jerusalem. It's called in Hebrew the Gate of Mercy. The Gate of Mercy. And this is where the Messiah. It was out of this gate that the whole city of Jerusalem came out and met Jesus crying, Hashanah haba, Hashanah haba, HaMashiach kavo.
Through that gate.
Through that gate. The Messiah, the year has come, the year has come, the Messiah is here. Mashiach ben David, the Messiah, the son of David. Hoshenu, 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 have mercy on us, have mercy on us, have mercy on us. That's the name of the gate of mercy.
King Hussein. Attempted to open it up.
That's right. But before that, there's two events. Now, let me show you the parallel of what happened. In 1917, the British had crushed all the way across the Sinai. They crushed through all the cities because they had developed a tank that could literally burst through the gates. In other words, they could back the old tank up and just run through those city gates. So the Turkish general had all the gates closed, and they filled. You remember being there that the gates are like a room. They have the inner and an outer gate, a crusader-type gate. And they filled all those gates with debris and stone so that the tanks could not break through. And then he was going to open the eastern gate and have access to the city, because this approach to the eastern gate is so steep that there's no tank. The old tanks could not go up that slope where the cemetery is now. Now, the Muslims had put the cemetery there for the same reason they closed the gate, to keep out the Jewish Messiah. The one thing they forgot to calculate is that when the Jewish Messiah comes, there will be no more cemeteries. Right? There will be the resurrection, so there will be no cemeteries. Now, with the opening of the Eastern Gate, the Turkish Sultan was going to make access into the city only through that gate. The day they started to work opening that gate, that is, the workmen started to take out the stone, a British observation plane flew over the city. It was the first time that the Arabs, the Jews, the Turks, or anyone had ever seen an airplane, so you can imagine the excitement that it caused in the city. And this little British observation plane flew around and threw out a note on a parachute from General Allenby demanding the city. The surrender of the city of Jerusalem. When the note was read to the Sultan or to the governor of Jerusalem, and it was signed by General Allenby, he thought they said Allah Bey, which means the Son of God in in the Turkish language.
Coming from an airplane.
That's right. And in the excitement, he surrendered Jerusalem.
Without a shot.
Because he, that's right, because he thought it, I mean, all this phenomena, you know, it was Allah Bey instead of Allenby.
That was very interesting. Did Allenby, he didn't ride in on a white horse at all. He walked in, didn't he?
He walked in the city of Truth.
But not through that gate.
No, he went, came in through the Jaffa Gate. Through the Jaffa Gate. That gate was never open.
All right. Now, what about King Hussein? What did he
do? Now, then, King Hussein was going to open that gate, and on Sunday, they brought in heavy equipment, air hammers, and all of this. On June the 4th, 1967, they brought in cranes, and they let big air hammers down into the eastern gate. All kind of equipment to take out these big stones that close the gate off, so they would have an access to the east side, since the west side would be closed with the hotel. Now, when they started to, the next morning, the workmen got there on Monday morning, and they started to work, getting everything set up to take the gate out. Monday morning, June the 5th, 1967, the six-day war started. And for the second time in our, in this century, the gate came within one day of being opened, and each time it changed hands. The city changed hands.
Well, it will not be open until the Messiah comes.
That's what Ezekiel said. And it's amazing that the two ruling governments in this century tried to open that gate, and the day they tried to open it, the city changed hands.
But when the Israelis captured the old mount of the old city of Jerusalem, do you think that that's the end of the Gentile period?
Yes, I do, because Jesus said that Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. Now, let's keep separate in our minds the times of the Gentiles from the fullness of the Gentiles. Two different subjects. The fullness of the Gentiles has to do with the church, the calling out from among the Gentiles a people for his name. The times of the Gentiles has to do with the time of Gentile world domination. And that goes back to the question of what will be the sign of thy coming and the end of this age, or the age of Gentile world domination and Gentile domination of Jerusalem. So that ended, and that, for the first time, united the city of Jerusalem as the Sola Rex capital of all Israel since King Solomon 2,500 years before.
Dr. Jones, it's interesting that you mentioned that you think the 1967 war, the main event being the possession of all of Jerusalem, the old city of Jerusalem, and I believe that's the part of the city that is really recognized by God, where the temple site is, that marked the time of the end of the Gentiles. And I believe at that time we brought that out in our publication, although some people disagreed with it. And it is amazing that also after that time, of course, we had the Vietnam War and the energy crisis. And it seems like that since that time, each and every month passes, more people, more nations become involved in the Middle East and concerned over Jerusalem and what has happened there. The energy crisis and now Russia coming down, the Iranian situation, the pact between Syria and Russia. It all seems to be snowballing towards one point, the bringing of all nations against Jerusalem. Do you have anything further to say on this?
I have something I had pointed out earlier this morning to Emil about this, and two things I would like to bring out. One is that our good friend in California, Dick Billings, is a stockbroker. And Dick pointed out to me that 1967 was a turning point of the world economy. The Six-Day War, the whole world economy, went into a chaotic situation that they've not been able to control since that time. In the Talmud, it says, when Carthage arose, Jerusalem fell. But when Jerusalem rearose, Carthage fell. So we're seeing this question of the Gentile powers. In the book of Zechariah, the 12th chapter and the 2nd verse, there is something that's very important, a tragic mistranslation of one word. He says, and I read from Zechariah chapter 12 and verse 2, "Behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of trembling unto all people round about, when they shall be in the siege both against Judah and against Jerusalem." Now, there's one word here that was mistranslated, and I would like to point that word out. The word trembling, the Hebrew word to tremble is ra'ad. Ra'ad is to tremble. But this word in the Hebrew text, if you will note, is not the word ra'ad, but the word ra'al. The word ra'al is poison. And he says, "I will make Jerusalem a cup of poison to all nations round about." Now, a lot of people became excited when all the nations who were friendly to Israel back this summer in 1980 withdrew their consulates and pulled out of Jerusalem. The United Nations abstained, or the U.S. abstained from voting on the question. Now, we say, does this mean that the U.S. and Israel's friends became enemies because they abstained? No, but because God said, "I will make Jerusalem a cup of poison." And if I have here a cup of poison and offer it to you and you abstain, it does not mean that you're necessarily my enemy, does it? And that's what God said he would make. So with this whole question of East Jerusalem, the government, the prime minister's office being moved to East Jerusalem, this is nothing new. This was declared in 1967. But at the time that the United Nations and the European committees were voting against Israel, they stood up, the Knesset, and said, "Jerusalem is united. Jerusalem is ours. We will remain. It's non-negotiable." And that was simply an act to tell the world that there's no change in the status of Jerusalem.
Now, when the Knesset took this action this last year, as reported by the AP on August 17, 1980, quote, "Saudi Arabia, the world's biggest oil exporter, declared that holy war is the only way to deal with Israel's annexation of Jerusalem." And they go on to recommend that all the Arab nations around about, or whoever would join them, would join in a holy war to deliver Jerusalem. Now, is there any, in your opinion, when is this going to happen?
Well, I think that of course, there's still several things that are happening in this area. There will be a final time when all nations will come up against Jerusalem and literally come up, but there must be a disarmament and all of those things before that happens, a world disarmament. And the nations will come up in the Valley of Jehoshaphat, which is the same as the Kidron Valley. And in the Valley of Jehoshaphat, he will judge the nations. The nations will be cut off. But this has to do with the coming, the final battle and the coming of Messiah. There will be other battles between now and then, but they must have more battles in order for God to force Israel to occupy more of what is rightfully theirs, because the Israelis don't want any more. You understand? The Lord has to force these wars to get Israel to possess their possession. The wars, as far as I'm concerned, it's like in the Torah, God is called Adonai Ishamil Kamag. God is, the Lord is a man of war, and that he is using the wars to bring about the fulfillment of this economy. Now, with regard to this, there's one another thing I would like to bring out, and that is that Rabbi Luria, who was called Ari of Safat, did a commentary several hundred years ago on Psalms 137. By the rivers of Babylon we sat down, yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. We hanged our harps on the willows thereof, for there they that carried us away captive required of us a song, and they that wasted us required of us mirth, saying, sing unto us one of the songs of Zion. And then they answered the Babylonians with this, how shall we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? If I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget it, her cunning. If I remember thee not, let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. If I prefer not Jerusalem above my chief joy. Now, Rabbi Luria, in the Shemona Esrei, or in the 18 benedictions of the Jewish daily prayer book, they quote this psalm, Im eshkeheha Yerushalayim tishkaha yamini. If I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget its cunning. Rabbi Luria pointed out that this is can be used as a prayer, but in reality it is not a prayer. It's not something that Israel prays to God for, but this is the Lord's song. It is God who is looking over the down from heaven on Jerusalem, and it is the Lord who sings, Im eshkeheha Yerushalayim. If I, the Lord, forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget his cunning. Now, he made a calculation based on that, where he said, taking the word tishkaha yamini, and in the Kabbalah it translates this way, Israel's Messiah from the Lord shall set a night guard on Jerusalem, yamini. Tishkaha is the numeric number of 5,728. Which was the Jewish year that Jerusalem was liberated, and Luria, Rabbi Luria, wrote that date several centuries before it happened, that Jerusalem would be delivered and reunited on, in the Jewish year, 5728, based on Tishkaha Yamini.
I don't believe I had heard that before. Now, another thing, Dr. Jones, that you know and I know that is going to have to happen before the Lord comes back, are the at least the time of Jacob's trouble, or the latter half of the tribulation begins, is the abomination of desolation. That must occur, and that cannot occur unless there is some structure in Jerusalem where the sacrifices will be offered up again. So, there has to be a temple, a tabernacle, or some structure in Jerusalem where this is going to take place. Now, our time is running out, so would you tell us, are we going to hear about this on the next message?
Let's wait till the next tape, and we'll talk about the reason the Mosque of Omar, or the Dome of the Rock, will not be torn down for the rebuilding of the temple.
That's good. We'll see you in the next broadcast.
Now, dear friends, there will be 6 or 7 broadcasts of this special roundtable on the Middle East featuring Reverend Vendell Jones and Dr. Emil Gaverluck, and Reverend Noah Hutchings will be assisting and asking questions. Don't miss a single broadcast. Today we continue our exciting roundtable with Reverend Vendell Jones, former pastor and student of the Middle East. Here once again, the Special Roundtable with Reverend Wendell Jones.
This is Emil Gaverluck with Noah Hutchings. We are interviewing Wendell Jones, who has some very interesting things to tell us. And we're going to ask him a question with regards to the coming abomination, which is going to be set up in the Holy of Holies in a temple on the mount there in the old Jerusalem city. So tell us, sir, your ideas on that.
All right. Well, again, my ideas are somewhat different from most that you hear. First of all, I do not think there's any scripture or any requirement that the Dome of the Rock has to be taken down or destroyed or earthquake or anything like that for the temple to be restored. The reason for that is that the temple of Solomon and the Herodian temple did not sit where the Dome of the Rock is located. It was never there. It was the Crusaders, not until the time of the Crusaders that they built the Knights of the Holy Temple built a church over the Dome of the Rock because it was the only thing over in the whole area that marked any area at all. And they said this is where the temple was. And that was not until the Crusaders that anybody ever had the idea that the temple ever stood there. And of course, after that it became the place of the temple. Like most holy places, they're always in the wrong place. Thank God. So that we could go see where they really are. Now, the temple stood to the north of the Dome of the Rock before the eastern gate. Josephus said that Solomon built a ramp coming from the bottom of the canyon of Jehoshaphat or Kidron, a ramp that went from the bottom of the valley up directly to the temple. Now, that would be in the area of the eastern gate, because there is a natural valley that goes up in that area. A natural valley that ascends up in that area. The next important thing about this particular aspect is that we have measurements in the Talmud that tell exactly where the temple was located. Rabbi Gorin, the present chief rabbi of Israel, when he was 17 years old, and he's a man in his 70s now, did a paper setting forth the very statement that the Holy Temple never stood in the area of the Dome of the Rock. Rabbi Cook, who was then the chief rabbi of Israel, reprimanded the young rabbinic student, telling him, "You are disagreeing with Rambam, Maimonides, you're disagreeing with Rashi, you're disagreeing with all these people, you know, the great Jewish scholars." And Rabbi Gorin said, "They read too many Christian books, and they have never been to Jerusalem. Some of these great expositors were not in Jerusalem, they didn't know the city." So Gorin made that measurement. Then after the Six-Day War, he was almost excommunicated again while he was chief rabbi of the army for taking Israeli soldiers on the Temple Mount, which is forbidden under rabbinic law, and taking measurements and determining exactly where the temple was located, which he did. And so, from a rabbinic point of view, it's impossible. The young Australian, the nut that went over to blow up the temple so the Jews could, the mosque, so the Jews could build another temple, didn't even get the right mosque if it had been. He said, that just shows how uninformed people are that have these opinions.
He went over to the Al-Aqsa Mosque. To the south.
To the south of it. And it's even south of, it is either farther south from where the temple wasn't, if you get the point. The temple was on the north side of the present mosque, the Dome of the Rock.
We'll get back to the temple, but let me ask you, you have a rather amazing idea about Shlomo Gorin.
Well, I did a paper, this paper back in 59 I was telling you about, based on a Kabbalistic interpretation of a New Testament text in Luke in the Olivet Discourse, whithersoever the body is, to the shall the eagles be gathered together. which indicated that the name of the religious leader at the time these things happened would be the same name as the place of the tabernacle and the temple. He would have the same name as the Beit HaMikdash.
So the man with that name would see a temple there and would also lead the sacrifices?
It would be there when all these things were restored. Now, the tabernacle was first set up where?
Shiloh.
In Shiloh, right?
Right.
And then later, the temple was built in Jerusalem beside the place of the offering of Isaac, which is the Gora, not on the place, but beside the place of the offering of Isaac.
Let me ask you this, Dr. Jones. Now, the Dome of the Rock is called the Dome of the Rock because it's a dome over a rock. Now, that big rock under the dome, now, do you accept that as the place, the literal place where Abraham offered up Isaac?
Right. That is the place that is called Eben Akedah, the Stone of the Binding.
But it was not inside the temple.
No. It was beside that.
Therefore,
the temple was built where the goat was hung, was caught in the thicket.
Yeah. Therefore, the Dome of the Rock cannot be on the spot where the temple was.
That's right.
It's rather obvious once you bring it up.
That's right. But when Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the goat caught in the thicket, the brazen altar stood where the goat was caught. That was what is in the Midrash. That where Abraham slew the offering for Isaac, on the north side, was a place of the brazen altar. The brazen altar was put at that place, and the temple fell respectively according to that location. It was not on the rock itself. That's where Abraham bound Isaac.
David and I have suggested the possibility that the great synagogue could possibly be. Now, we have never said it would be, because we know there has to be some place in Jerusalem where the sacrifices will be reinstituted again. But we have suggested that the great synagogue could be the place, because they could put the altar out in front of it. It would have room, so and so on, and it's next to Hekau Stomo, which is Solomon's temple, and that is where the rabbinical offices will be. And there was a great synagogue council in Jerusalem after the Jews returned from Babylon.
All right.
So on these facts are events, and the fact that Revelation 11 and I think it's Ezekiel 65 or 66 indicates that the temple might be out of place or this place. Now, you said you do not believe the great synagogue will be the temple. Could you give us your reason?
Okay. And I'm glad I'm with people that entertain disagreement. The reason I do not believe that the great synagogue has anything to do with the restored temple is that God said the place that I will choose to put my name there will be in Jerusalem in the tribe of Judah. Now, that Hekel Shalomo means the palace of Solomon.
Okay.
Okay. And the Hekel Shalomo is in the tribe of Benjamin today, not in the tribe of Judah, because it's on the west side of the Valley of Hinnom, the Hinnom Valley. And everything west of the Hinnom Valley was considered the tribe of Benjamin. So it's not even in the tribe of Judah. For the temple to be restored, it has to be restored exactly and precisely where it was originally. And that has already been determined by the rabbinate where that will be. No sacrifice could be offered anywhere except in the very place that the sacrifices of old were offered.
Now, they've used a verse here in Isaiah 66:1 that talks about the fact that heaven house that ye build unto me. Mm-hmm. Implying that it's not built in the right place.
Okay, where
so
is
this
it?
Is why we thought here that okay. the...
okay, but who's asking
where
is
it? Could be it?
Okay, but in the 66th chapter of Isaiah, we must remember that he's speaking of the destroyed temple. The time that God said there will be a time when I will not accept your sacrifices. And I believe that's that chapter that if you kill an ox, it's like killing a dog. If that the sacrificial system will be abbreviated, not terminated. But there'll be a time when there will be no sacrifices. Then later, the sacrifices will be restored. I believe Isaiah 66 is, he that killeth an ox, verse 3, as if he slew a man, and he that sacrificed a lamb, as if he cut off a dog's neck. He that offered oblation, so forth. So, swine's blood. So, this is talking about the time, and that's why the Jews, since the destruction of the temple in AD 70, have had no altar, they have had no sacrificial system. Now, there is a sequence of things that must happen before these things can be restored. There is a certain sequence of things that must happen. Israel must be at least 30 years old. Well, they were 30 years old in 1977-78. In May 1978, Israel turned their 30th year.
That's the age of maturity.
That's right. In in the book of Leviticus, chapter 4 and verse 3, it says, from 30 years even to the 50th year shalt thou number for the priesthood. So the priesthood began in the 1977-78 with a change of government. And I've got tapes that I cut back in 74, 75, 76, stating that the only person in Israel that was offering a change in government was Menachem Begin. And I've got calls from all over the country that I predicted. I didn't predict anything. I just said that the only one that can offer a real change in government from the Labor Party, we know that there's got to be a total revolutionary change in government in the 30th year. Okay, Begin brought that. Now, what will happen between the 30th and 50th year? First of all, the ashes of the red heifer must be found and returned to Israel. There must be, every time there's a breakdown, internal breakdown and crises before God does some great thing, like in 67, the economy of Israel was terrible. It was tragic. In 1977, the government of Israel became so corrupt and critical before the change. So each time there's a crisis before the climax, you see. Here we see that there must be crises, and out of that crisis will come the return of the ashes of the red heifer, the restoration of the Sanhedrin court, the separation of the religious party, taking the religious party out of the civil government of Israel as it is today, and all religious law will be determined by the Sanhedrin. Then the restoration of the priesthood, which could be done tomorrow. I mean, that's already, they know who will be the priest and all that. That could be done tomorrow. There's no problem there. But they have to be reinstituted, and they cannot be reinstituted, and the Sanhedrin cannot be re-inaugurated until they have the water of purification, which is the water of the ashes of the red heifer. Now, that's very pivotal. And at that time, all religious Jews are required to move back to Israel. That's another aspect of the red heifer. Then, after these things happen, the Ark of the Covenant and the tabernacle that Moses built and Bezalel built in the Sinai will be archaeologically recovered and returned to Israel, and it will be set up and healed and made as it was in the days that out of the land of Egypt.
You actually believe that that will be discovered?
That will be discovered.
By a goyim?
Well, and it, the text indicates in the book of Amos chapter 9, as quoted by James in Acts 15, that thus saith the Lord, the Gentiles that is called by my name doeth all these things. There's also a passage in the Solomonic dedication concerning the stranger that shall come from a far country because he shall hear thy great name and so forth. And he will come and pray toward this place, do all that that stranger asketh. The nokri, the stranger, means one that is not an Israelite. And in 1968, there was a meeting of all the Jews, Ashkenazic and Sephardic Jews of the world, to determine what to do now that we have the temple area back. And it was determined that they were to do nothing because the one that would bring all these things back would be someone who was not a Jew. Someone who was not a Jew, a Nokri, would return all these things. And so they tabled it, waiting on the Nokri to do it. Now we'll just have to wait and let time be the interpreter of how these things are going to happen. But we know pretty well the area, the Copper Scroll, in the Dead Sea collection, tell us where the ashes of the red heifer were hidden. The book of Maccabees in the Apocrypha, 2 Maccabees chapter 5, gives a historical account of where Jeremiah the prophet hid the Ark of the Covenant and the Tabernacle. Now, there have already been people looking for it, and it has not been found, because that place will not be made known until the day that it's to happen. And I still think that for that part of it, we're still just a wee bit early.
Dr. Jones, you mentioned that the Ark of the Covenant and the Tabernacle, by that I assume you mean the post and the feet of the post and the fabrics and the beaver skins and all that. You're talking about that literal fabric and skin.
That's right.
Is going to be discovered along with that ark that was in the tabernacle that held the law and Aaron's rod
and
the pot of manna.
That's right.
Now, and you think that that same ark must be discovered and brought forth.
The same ark and the same tables of the law and everything must be discovered and brought back.
Do you think Jeremiah hid the ark?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Now, I have been in the mines there, Solomon's mines.
Solomon's quarries.
Quarries. And you go back under the temple, you know, and it's a monstrous thing. Few people who go to Jerusalem have ever go in that. And they should, because it's a tremendous experience, because it seems like you go forever.
Nobody ever goes to Jerusalem with Bendel Jones. It doesn't go in there and into the cave of Zedekiah that goes all the way underground to the Dead Sea. We don't go all the way through it, but we go in to see where he went down.
But certainly, if you go to Jerusalem, go with a tour group that's going to take you through this Solomon's Quarry. And you go right back under the temple, right up under the rock.
Yeah, but you can't go all the way down there because they closed it off. And there's another weird story connected with that happened in 67. But you see, Solomon quarried the stone directly under the temple area to build the temple.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Now then, the quarry of the temple became the sepulcher of the tabernacle. The tabernacle was wrapped like an Egyptian mummy and buried in that quarry where the stone was taken out. And Jeremiah the prophet, when the Babylonians took the city, came in and took that Ark of the Covenant and the tabernacle and took it through this underground caravan all the way to the Dead Sea, crossed the Jordan River, and took it into Mount Nebo.
Okay.
Now which is today in Jordan.
You don't think he hid it in the cave there?
No, no. He took it. It says very definitely that he took it to the land of Moab, in the mountain, in the valley of the mountain where Moses climbed up and saw the heritage of the Lord.
All right, you'll have to tell us where you got this.
Where I've got what?
Book of Maccabees.
The Book of Maccabees is in the Apocrypha. It's the historical books in the Apocrypha.
I have a series of Old Testament commentaries by Kyle and Delish, and they say the same thing that you have just said.
Well, that proves that I'm not original, and it proves they're right.
I've got a blockbuster I'm going to drop right here, because we have a mutual friend in California who believes that you're the man that's going to discover it.
I would like to be, but I am not. I would rejoice just as much if somebody else did. I'm not pretentious about it, but I do have an excavation going on now looking for the ashes of the red heifer, and everything we have found has been most positive.
Dr. Jones, would you care to go into some detail, or could you, let me say, I know you're restricted in what you can say on that subject, but in the next program, tomorrow, could you go into a little more detail about your search for the Ashes Red Heifer? There are a lot of people who have written us wanting information about your project to find that some way they've gotten word that you're out looking for the Ashes Red Heifer.
Well, I haven't tried to advertise it, but it's pretty well known, and I could talk about it, but I don't want to go too much. Don't ask me for any measurements, okay?
All right. But tomorrow,
I'll tell you what the density.
Tomorrow, you will tell the people, our listeners, something about the Ashes Red Heifer and your efforts to find them.
I will tell them exactly what the Dead Sea Scrolls say. I will tell them what we have found. But I will not tell them where it is unless they're smart enough to read Hebrew and go find it. If they are, they'll have to wait till we get through digging, because we have a lease on the cave. Join us for today's exciting roundtable. The roundtable with Dr. Gaverlock, Reverend Hutchings, and special guest, Reverend Vendel Jones.
Emil Gaverlock speaking. We're interviewing Vendel Jones, who is a Hebrew scholar and who has lived a good part of his life in Israel and who has some very interesting, very exciting things to tell us. We want to know more about your search for the ashes of the red heifer. Why is that so important, these so-called ashes of the red heifer?
They are important to the eschatology of Israel because this has to happen before the Council of the Sanhedrin, before they can have a priesthood, and before the Orthodox Jew recognizes Israel as being authentic.
Now, these ashes are actually the ashes of the last heifer that was offered as a sacrifice back how far back?
Okay, in Numbers, the 19th chapter, you have a whole chapter devoted to the ashes of the red heifer. In the book of Hebrews, chapter 10, it refers to the sprinkling of the water of the ashes of the red heifer.
So the last heifer was sacrificed how long ago?
From Moses until the destruction of the temple, the last heifer was offered immediately before the destruction of the temple and was never used.
AD 70,
okay.
That's almost 2,000 years ago.
That's right. Now, between Moses and the last one that was offered, there were only 7 cows sacrificed in the entire history of Israel.
The red heifer is rare?
There were only 7 offered in all the history of Israel. 7.
I'm intrigued by someone who told me that already a red heifer has appeared in Israel.
Oh.
Is that somebody right?
They can't offer another red heifer. It has to be that one. The last one that was offered. Because
the last one was offered in AD 70.
Right. They have to have those ashes. Those ashes, no other. water would last for weeks.
Is that right? Just a pinch of it.
Just a pinch of
it. Just like a pinch of salt.
Just the lightest amount was sufficient to fulfill the symbol. That's right. It was not that they had to get ash dirty when they used it, but just a little of the ash in the water made the water clean. Now, no sacrifice in the entire Levitical economy was so typical of the sacrifice of Jesus as the ashes of the red heifer. Because the ashes of the red heifer, the cow was killed outside the horse gate. The cow was killed outside the horse gate. That's strange, isn't it?
No cow gate.
No cow gate. The horse gate. And the horse gate was what is today the Damascus Gate on the north side of the city. He suffered reproach without the camp. And where is Golgotha? Just outside the Damascus Gate. You see the parallel that Paul is bringing?
Yeah.
You see that? Now, it had to be offered a whole burnt sacrifice. Most of the sacrifices, the priest and the people ate part of the sacrifice. But this sacrifice had to be burned, all of it. They took the dung of the cow, and they mixed it with clay, and they made a vessel. And this vessel was called the kalal.
A pot?
A pot. A clay pot had with clay and cow dung.
A kalal.
Kalal. Kalal, it was called. And this vessel was fired in a low temperature kiln and used for the ashes of the red heifer. That's what the urn was.
How much ash would there be?
With the wood and the so forth at the altar, it would be like about 3 gallons or less.
It'd be like this.
The pot would be a nice size, whole. Less than 3 gallons.
You're holding your hands about a foot apart and about 7 or 8 inches high.
Yeah, it would be a big vessel for holding the ashes of the red heifer.
Bigger than that.
Now then, when they used all those ashes and they offered another heifer, they took the pot and the ashes that remained, the ash that remained in this pot, and they put that on the cow, and they offered that with the cow in the next offering. So that each time there was a carryover from the last time, or times, so that in the last one that was killed is some remnant of the ashes of the first red heifer.
The apostolic succession of the red heifers.
That's right. And that's why today, that being a red cow in Israel, there's a lot of red cows in Israel.
There are a lot of them.
A lot of them.
How would you know if you discovered the ashes of the red heifer? Would there be something to identify that?
Yes, first of all, the type of vessel that it is in and where it is found. And now let me quote from the Dead Sea Scrolls. The copper scroll reads, on the way from Jericho to Sukkah, by the Wadi Hakifa, in the tomb of Zadok the priest, which is a cave that has two openings. On the opening on the side by the north, with the view toward the east, dig 2.5 cubits under the plaster.
You weren't going to give us all this.
And there will be found the kalal, and under it one book. Now, other places in the scroll say that the Zadok was the priest of Solomon, who was buried in the mountain of the Azazel, where they took the scapegoat, in the valley of Achor, Mount Arunah, which is the place when they took the scapegoat on Yom Kippur and let it go, the Azazel, he was buried in that hill. Okay? This is very striking because other places in the scroll keep referring back and forward to this particular passage. It says the book that is with the Kalal is another copy of this book written in simply with simple words. In other words, there's no double talk. With this Para Aduma, the Kalal, will be another copy of the copper scroll written with simple language with exact dimension and measurements of all things. Now, the all things referred to in that scroll are the artifacts that the Essenes had taken out of the temple before the Romans destroyed it and hid them. All the things that were important. And some of the things that the Romans thought they were taking away that were genuine were really duplications of the real thing. So, many 67 places are named where they hid sometimes one to three or four.
The book you think is the scroll.
The scroll, it says it is a copy of this scroll.
They didn't have books like we have today.
No, they were scrolls. It was written on a copper plate.
You've discovered some plaster, a plaster floor.
Yes, by the way, I was in Jordan and got to go over and see the copper scroll at the museum.
Did you really?
Yeah.
They have it in Jordan?
They have it in Jordan.
At Amman?
At Amman, in the museum at Amman, and it's on display. You can see it there.
I thought that Israel had all the scrolls.
They don't have that one because that was found in 1952. But we know there's other scrolls that have not been found. We know that. But it's a matter of getting money to get in there and find them. You know, it takes money to go in and excavate. We spent, $25,000 to $30,000 on our excavation and are waiting now to get more funds to go back and finish the dig. It's a problem. It's expensive to dig down there.
You find some wood.
Okay, in 1968, there is no such thing as a cave down there with a plaster floor. It's just all the caves that have been excavated, they have never found a plaster floor. But it says this has a plaster floor. Now, this is very striking because it said it's also the cave of the tomb of the high priest, the Zadok, the priest of Solomon.
You expect to find his bones in there?
We don't. We won't tell anybody. Okay. That's something that we never. If we're digging and find a tomb, when I'm digging and find a tomb, I never touch the bones, and I never tell anybody what I found. I seal it back. I have certain respect for the dead that some archaeologists don't have. Okay. I don't like to pick up bones. I think that there's a certain sanctity to the tomb that should be respected. Find the tomb of Zadok the priest, it will be sealed and made inaccessible because we don't play with it. I don't care whether a priest or not, you just should not disturb. I just don't think that we would want somebody going into a cemetery disturbing our family's bones, would we? Huh? Well, why should we have any liberty to go back to people buried 2,000 years ago and play with their bones? I just don't think it's ghoulish.
Now you found a floor, plaster floor, and also some wood.
Well, the first thing that I did in 1968, this cave had already been excavated, but it fit the description perfectly. Perfectly the description. But there you could see where they had excavated all the way to bedrock and no evidence of Qumran occupation, Essene occupation. I had spent many weeks working in the desert exploring. So I went to this cave. It looked so convincing that I went, since it's supposed to be buried at the entrance, at that time I certainly did not want to find anything. It wasn't time. It wasn't the 30th year. The chief rabbi was Rabbi Unterman, not Rabbi Gorin. So there were several things that were. So I went halfway back in the cave. I stepped off. It was 66 steps from the front of the cave, about 100 feet from the front.
A natural cave.
So I stepped off 33 steps to the center of the cave, and I dug about 5 feet down and found the most beautiful plaster floor you've ever seen. On top of that floor, I found pottery from the Qumran period, the thin eggshell pottery of the Qumran period.
So you dated it there.
Oh, yeah. That's on top. I dug through the plaster floor.
You go through it.
I did dug through it. I found is a special thing. It's a very thin eggshell pottery by the Essenes. But the early pottery is just early Roman. We call it early Roman pottery, Herodian pottery, early Roman pottery. And all the pottery in the field was that earlier, thicker pottery, where the pottery on the surface was Qumran. Now, when we got into the cave and got to excavating, what we found is that before the people of Qumran left, that they went into the wall and they pried the strike of this hill is vertical, and they pried out the stone and fell it over the floor all the way through the cave. Big boulders. So that what the archaeologists thought was bedrock was indeed the walls that they had intentionally fallen in from both sides to cover their floor. Pretty clever of them. Right. Now then, under, digging around these rocks and under these rocks, on the floor, we also found chalcolithic pottery. Now this is strange because chalcolithic pottery dates back another 2,000 years before the Qumran people.
It's a long time before.
So, what is chalcolithic pottery doing laying on a plaster floor with Qumran pottery? When I saw it, I turned to the archaeologist, Pesach Baradon. I said, Pesach, what is this? And he grabbed it, and you've never seen anybody go so wild. He said, the only place we have found this is at the Bar Kokhba Caves in Nahal Hever. And it was because they found chalcolithic pottery on the same level with Qumran pottery that they assumed what? That there had to be some digging and burying done in that area.
Bar Kokhba, that's what, back in the Maccabees?
No, that's 137 A.D.
Right there, all right.
Okay. So they found where chalcolithic pottery with pottery of the Bar Kokhba period lay on the surface. So they calculated that pottery from 2,800 years before to be up here with this, they had to dig. Now, they were not archaeologists. If they were digging to bury something and they came to a piece of pottery, what would they normally do with it? Just slang it out on the floor, right? Just slang it out of the way. Throw it aside.
Dig up all the trash.
Throw it aside and then bury what they're going to bury.
Cover it back.
And leave the pottery laying around on the floor.
Yeah.
So we found a lot of chalcolithic pottery.
So you haven't dug far enough.
Oh, yeah. Well, the problem is we can't get the rocks out. They're dolomite and it's impossible to break them with a sledgehammer or anything like that. We tried
a bulldozer.
And we're going to have to get power equipment up there. I went up. This past July, we went up. Dr.
Your son is doing this with you, huh?
Yes, my son has been working there with me, and we've had three different excavation crews in there. We've done all the excavating we can do till we get the big boulders out of the way. We can't do anything else. Now, to compound this, out at the front of the cave, where it's at the entrance, there was an earthquake, evidently about the 8th, 9th century, that came the whole front end of the cave. Cave off on the Byzantine level of occupation. So, with the Byzantine level being where it is, and the whole ceiling of the cave is on top of that, so we've got to take off the ceiling, take off the Byzantine, the Roman level, then take out the rocks that were fallen in before that earthquake, and then get down to the plaster floor, and then go under the plaster floor all the way up to the front. And we have already discovered that the plaster floor goes at least 35 feet out beyond the entrance of the cave today. My son did that work there.
Is that right? 35. Do you expect to find anything else there if they've covered so much with the plaster?
Oh, yeah. We've got to get all those rocks out to find what we're looking for. And see, you've got two caves involved, and it describes things being hidden in both caves. We have permission through the Institute of Judeo-Christian Research to excavate these caves, and as long as we keep the excavation active every third year, and at least every third year we excavate it, it stays under our domain. Nobody else can excavate there.
You might find all that treasure supposedly buried somewhere
a scenario as to what you think will happen once you discover this? What happens? Now, you've got the Rabbi Shlomo Goren on the scene. No.
Roundtable with Reverend Wendell Jones. the next broadcast. God bless you, each and every one. God is still on the throne, and prayer changes things. We're glad to greet you in the wonderful name of our God and Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ, our coming Redeemer. We trust you will join us once again for an enlightening roundtable discussion with a remarkable man, Reverend Wendell Jones. Here once again, the roundtable with Reverend Wendell Jones.
This is Emil Gaverlick. We're interviewing Wendell Jones in this very special series with a man who is a Hebrew scholar and who is doing some very exciting things, excavating archaeological work, doing some teaching in Israel, and a remarkable man. So, we are talking about the discovery of the ashes of the red heifer, which doesn't mean much to a Gentile, but to a devout Jew, it means a great deal, doesn't it?
That's right. It should mean more to us. Dr. Gaverlick, if we understood Judaism better, we'd understand the New Testament better. You know, the strange thing about the ashes of the red heifer is that the offering in Judaism is said it was different from every other offering. It was a cow and not a bull. It was offered outside the gate, not at the altar.
Now, that's the only female offering.
That's right.
Of all of the offerings.
That's right. And did you know?
The why?
Okay. The why? Because why did Judas Iscariot covet? How many pieces of silver did he covet for?
30?
30 pieces of silver. What were 30 pieces of silver the value of? What was this? What came from the temple treasure? Now, there was one thing that was put in that temple treasure every day that was valued at 30 pieces of silver.
Don't look at me. You have the answer.
Okay. The price of the redemption of a woman was 30 pieces of silver, and the price of the redemption of a man was 50 pieces of silver. So Judas sold Jesus for the price of a woman, the redemption of a woman.
I have spent 13 years beyond my bachelor's degree in seminaries, some universities. Honestly, I never heard this.
Aha. Uh-huh. And the place that they bought was Atalama, which is a field of blood. But the word blood is in the feminine. And it could be very easily Ish-a-dama, Ish-a-dama, which means the field of the woman's blood.
What's the significance of it?
What's the significance of it? For why did Christ die?
Come on, give us the answer.
The church is always in the feminine, isn't it?
Now you're getting to it.
Huh? The word for synagogue is Beit HaKnesset, masculine. The word in Hebrew for church is Beit HaKnesia, the feminine form of the same word. Now, the red cow spoke of the redemption of the nations. And when the man who was to sprinkle the Sanhedrin court at the sanctification of the Sanhedrin court, they took a clean man, a man who was ritually pure and sanctified. And this clean man took the water of the ashes of the red heifer, and he lined the Sanhedrin up before the temple, and he took the water of the ashes of the red heifer, and he sprinkled it on all 70 men. And by the sprinkling of the water of the ashes of the red heifer, they became clean. But the man who did the purification became unclean.
So he had to go purify himself again.
Get the picture? God has made him to be sin for us, and you know sin, that we might be made the righteousness of God in him.
All right.
The picture of the
ashes of the red heifer. That's what they did. No other sacrifice did that. Only the ashes of the red heifer. Did the pure, sinless, pure atoner become defiled in the purification of the unclean? God made him to be sin for us who knew no sin, that we might be made the righteous of God in him. He bore our sins on the tree, the cedar wood, the hyssop, all that was connected with the crucifixion was involved in the ashes of the red heifer. You remember the tree, the cedar wood, the hyssop on a stick with the vinegar. All that is connected with the ashes of the red heifer. So it has a lot to do with the New Testament, but there's not, in the average seminary or with seminary professors, you can start talking to about the ashes of the red heifer, and they wonder where that's coming from. The whole 19th chapter of Numbers is dealing with the ashes of the red heifer, but Christians are totally unaware of what it's all about, and no sacrifice is more important to our economy, figuratively, than the ashes of the red heifer.
So once these are rediscovered, the actual ashes of a heifer that was offered up back in A.D. 70, almost 2,000 years ago, you believe that those are out, that is somewhere in existence, and that somebody's going to discover it.
I believe that it's in a cave on the road between Jericho and Succoth, by the Wadi Hakifa.
If it is there,
understand, and I'm not saying, oh, no, it's there. I know, based on what I know from the scrolls and what I know from the geography and the history and the archaeology of the land, it's the only place they could be is in this cave. I do not know of another wadi that has a cave with two openings beside it in the whole desert that fits it. There is not. It does not exist. I have been up every wadi, over 30 wadis from Wadi Hogla all the way to Wadi Mishmar and David in Ein Gedi. I've been up all of them. Several miles up and down and over. There's not another wadi that has a cave that meets this description.
Now, once you discover this, you give this to Rabbi Shlomo Goren.
No strings attached.
And then he takes it from there.
It's his problem. It's not mine. Somebody said, how are you going to prove they're right? It's not my job to prove they're right. I couldn't care less. If I find a pot made with cow's dung and full of ashes, I could, with a scroll and a book, I will simply turn that over to chief rabbis of Israel, the two chief rabbis of Israel, and I'm not going to try to prove it. It's not my job. Somebody said, why, if you proved it, the Christian world would never accept it. I don't care whether they do or not. If those two rabbis accept it, I could care less whether Rome or Nashville either accepted it. I don't care.
That's not true. The Christian world wouldn't accept it, only a certain segment.
Well, I wouldn't care whether any of them did. I don't care. If I find it, return it to the rabbis. It's their decision. And what the Christian world says about it, I couldn't care less.
We would be thrilled at its major discovery.
Many would. Many Christians
certainly
would.
I think the evangelicals would be very thrilled with it. Now, the rabbi takes this and he takes it from there. He establishes a priesthood. You say it's already
possible. The first thing he's got to do is establish the authenticity of to be sure that it is the ashes of the red heifer.
All right. Supposing
that is his job. It's not mine.
He's done that now, the priesthood. And then, after that, now we get into the discovery of the
At that time,
what kind of a temple is it that's going to be on that?
Okay, at that time, every Orthodox Jew in the world has to return to the land of Israel. All of them.
All over the world?
That's right. That will bring the great Aliyah.
Every Orthodox Jew?
Every believing Orthodox Jew in the world will be required by Jewish law to return with the return of the ashes of the red heifer.
Well, isn't that something? All right, now the Temple Mount. And here, to build a building would take a long while. But you could have one almost instantaneously with a major discovery that you're talking about.
Okay, if the Mishkan, the tabernacle,
Moses and Aaron built in the wilderness when they came out of Egypt 33 centuries ago, that Jeremiah hid, according to 2 Maccabees chapter 2, verses 1 through 6, is recovered, and it will be recovered, and returned to Israel according to 2 Maccabees, and according to the book of Amos chapter 9, according to the book of Acts chapter 15. All three speak of the same thing. The Sukkah David, the Mishkan, that will be recovered and returned to Israel. No Jew is going to be rebuild a temple. No Jewish organization is going to sponsor a rebuilding of the temple. But if the Ark of the Covenant is found and returned and restored and renewed as Amos and as 2 Maccabees, Jeremiah's prophecy in 2 Maccabees chapter 5.
By renewed you mean restored, but not by man.
What I mean is, and the breaches thereof shall be healed, and it shall be made anew as it was in the day when they came out of the land of Egypt, and the glory as it was in the days of Solomon. That means the Shekinah, the Shekinah glory.
That
the Shekinah glory will come
light.
The glory of God will fill that tabernacle again. Now, Ezekiel describes a temple that will be built around that tabernacle. Because when he describes all the courts on the north and on the south and facing the east, and the massive columns towering into the heavens, he says, and in the midst of them, that is between the columns, on the north and south side, facing the east, backing the west, he said, in the midst of these shall be the tabernacle of the Lord of hosts.
You're talking about an astrodome over the top of this tabernacle.
That's right. The future temple will be a cover over the tabernacle itself. It will not be something that's built, so to speak, rebuilt. It will be the tabernacle restored, and this building will simply be put there to protect it. And that will be on the north side of the Dome of the Rock. It will not be interfered. The rock has nothing to do with it. Ezekiel described the temple, the rebuilding of the temple, that he went up from the eastern gate, and the temple stood before the eastern gate, not where the Dome of the Rock is. And he went up three levels, and today there are three levels, from the level of the entrance to the gate, the stairway that goes up, a second ascent, and the third ascent puts you up on the level of the platform.
And there's room there for all of that, right now.
All of it. And he went directly in front of the eastern gate and to the place of the table of the altar, which was where they laid the sacrifices in front of the brazen altar. And he measured to the north so far, then he measured to the back to the west, then he turned back and measured to the south, and the angel said, stop. The angel brought him back to the altar where he started. He measured again a short distance from the altar back to the south to a parallel line, going across to where the other line had stopped on the back side, the west side, near the western wall. And he said, stop and measure it not, for it is left to the profane place. So, according to Ezekiel's prophecy, the Dome of the Rock will remain there and be coexistent with the temple, but will be separated by the measurement of the temple, and the temple area will not be included.
The profane place is the Dome of the Rock.
That's right. The profane place spoken of by Ezekiel is the Dome of the Rock.
Do you know what you are saying?
Yes.
The fact is that the two witnesses will be preaching during the time of the tribulation. Elijah definitely is named. We have been saying the other one is going to be Moses. Moses will be actually, in a sense, working with the very tabernacle that he worked with when he was on earth.
If Moses and Elijah are the tribulation,
the two witnesses. What about the abomination of desolation that's going to be set up in a temple on the Temple Mount? All right, now what does that mean?
Okay, well, we have been guilty again of pigeonholing and making everything the same, throwing all into one thing. We need not to speak if the Bible doesn't speak. We need to separate and not try to make everything be synonymous. Yom Kippur.
On Yom Kippur. This is a blood, he had to carry blood with him.
To offer
for the sins of Israel. Is that right? That's the Old Testament.
That's right.
Now that has got to be reestablished.
That's right. And blood sacrifices are going to be reestablished according to Ezekiel 30 and 39.
Now, of course, we are told the scripture that the day that Jesus died, that veil in front of the temple was rent in twain from the top to the bottom.
It also says that in the Midrash. The Jewish Midrash has a whole Midrash on the tearing of the veil and the sewing of the veil and all that.
So they have a record of it there.
Certainly they do.
All right, now,
it's a Jewish record.
Right in that area, that's where the abomination is going to be set up.
Right.
What is this abomination? Is it going to be a mechanical, electronic device?
What does the Bible say? He will make an image. What is an image? A statue of himself. And he will set that statue in the Holy of Holies. Now, Jesus said, quoting Daniel, when you see the abomination that maketh desolate, standing where it ought not, that he that is on Judea, flee to the mountains and so forth. Alright? Now, when the Antichrist, there is in the Kabbalah the tradition of the creation of the Golem. When one receives the holy name of God to prove that he can pronounce the name properly, he takes a piece of clay, a Kabbalist, and he forms it without a face, but in the form of a human body with legs and arms, but no face, no eyes. And he pronounces the name of God over this piece of clay, and when he does, this piece of clay becomes a living thing, a being, but not a soul, a soulless being. And this soulless being is called a golem, the creation of the golem. And he writes across his forehead, Amet, Aleph Mem Tav, while the clay is still wet, so that if this comes to life, he can rub out the olive and it leaves Met, which means death, and he dies. It ceases to be. It turns back to clay. And there's many warnings about creating the golem. They have to be very careful about it. Because if you leave it, the first day it will call you my master, the second day it will call you my brother, and the third day it will call you my servant. And it will become so strong that it will rule over you, and so strong it will rule over all men, and it will rule the earth. There's a very big horror story about this golem. That simply means that the Antichrist, who is much like the Christ, will know the correct pronunciation of God's name. That he will make an image of himself, put it in the temple, and pronounce God's name, holy name, unutterable name, over this image, and this image will become a living being, and then he, the Antichrist, will declare that the whole world shall bow down and worship his image, the golem of himself. And the story of the beast is the golem. It's a golem. And no, nothing is hid from him. Is totally knows everything that's going on in the world. Nothing could be contrived against him.
Will that thing be Satan possessed then?
The Antichrist is Satan possessed. This is more than Satan possessed. This beast is a being without a soul. It's something that's never
but controlled by Satan. Obviously by the Antichrist.
It won't even be, it'll control the Antichrist. This beast, this golem is what is cast into the lake of fire and will burn forever and ever. It's not the Antichrist. What I mean, the beast and the Antichrist are not the same thing. The beast is the image of the Antichrist. The golem of the Antichrist is cast into the lake of fire burning with brimstone.
Now this is what's going to control the world?
And this is going to be, this is why I flee to the mountains. Flee, you know, get out. This is when the warning comes to Israel, the abomination of desolation.
When you see this abomination.
That's right. Now, you asked a question a while ago about the church and so forth. There's not anything about the church in all this business. You know that? The church is never mentioned with regard to when we need the poorest in the swamp. When it comes to this whole question of historical premillennialism, amillennialism, and all these questions, the eschatology is not the real problem. It's the whole premise of their thinking and their attitude toward Israel.
All right, let's do that in our next broadcast.
Okay.
But you don't see the church present while this goes on in the world.
I ask you, is there any mention of the church in Matthew 24, 25, Luke 21, Mark 13, Revelation 13? There's no mention of it. Whatever, it's all Judah and Jerusalem and all that. It's only these people that spiritualize Israel and make the church Israel. In other words, if you put the church back to Abraham in the Old Testament and call Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob primitive Christians and say the Jews have been done away with and Christianity replaced Judaism, then you've got to get the church in the tribulation period. You can't help it.
You end up there.
You end up there.
Well, we're not there.
But if you leave the church as a separate entity, called out from among the Gentiles and let Israel go ahead and exist as Israel without interference, then you never have the problem. The problem doesn't even exist.
All right, now we've got the abomination. This abomination then is going to say to the people of Israel, bow down and worship me.
No, the Antichrist that created the golem will command the whole world to worship the beast.
Now, two-thirds of the population of Israel is going to do that.
No. I think
Zechariah says.
I know, but wait a minute. No, I think we're dumping a passion there that doesn't belong at that particular place. Okay, let's leave Zechariah right now. Because this has to do with the nations that come against Jerusalem. It's related in the end time. But let's leave that for right now. Because he tells Jerusalem and Judea to flee, to get out.
Jesus said that to those who are in Judea.
Yeah. And he's not talking to Christians when he says that.
Right.
He's talking to Jews when he says that. And the same warnings come from rabbinic literature. That's the reason a lot of Jews oppose even the rebuilding of the temple. They don't want to put the circumstances in their lifetime where that could happen. Just got out of it. You see, the Jews interpret Holocaust as a time of Jacob's trouble. And the tribulation is something else. We put it all in one basket.
Let's save this for the next broadcast.
Okay.
We'll get into all of this. We'll just climax this broadcast with a statement that you believe that the church is not going to go through the tribulation period. And we think this is very exciting.
You know, I'm sure that everyone will enjoy this special roundtable featuring Reverend Vendel Jones, Dr. Gaverluck, and Reverend Hutchings. Until tomorrow, God bless you, each and every one. God is still on the throne, and prayer changes things. It's good to greet you in our familiar salutation. Invite you to stay tuned for another 3 days of Roundtable on the Middle East. It's so interesting to talk to a man who has lived in the country, who is able to speak the language of the people, the language of Hebrew, and a man who has devoted much of his life to studying the history and the customs of the Jews. Here once again, the Roundtable with Reverend Hutchings, Dr. Gaverluck, and our guest, Reverend Vendel Jones.
This is Errol Gaverluck, and again, we are continuing our series with our guest, Vendel Jones, who is a Hebrew student, Hebrew scholar, and yet one of us, so to speak, who is very knowledgeable on the various things that are happening today in Israel, and we thought we would bring to inform you. Noah Hutchings is here to pose his questions as well, so we're in for another good session together. Noah, do you want to start?
Yes, Brother Jones. of our listeners are interested in the buzzards or vultures that have been reported appearing in Israel. Of course, their interest is motivated by the fact that we read in Revelation 19 and also in the Old Testament. There are some scriptures which allude to the fact that when the armies of Antichrist that are gathered there at Megiddo, and as you brought out, I believe the Kidron Valley, that the God will bring the birds, the vultures, or the eagles, as one scripture indicates, to eat the flesh of these possibly millions of men, or hundreds of thousands of men, that are going to be slain there. Now, there have been various reports about the buzzard population in Israel that has been increasing, but frankly, I have been over there for the past several years, and also right there in Megiddo, and I haven't seen any buzzards. I've seen some storks and pelicans and another type of bird over there, similar to our crow, but can you tell us about the buzzards in Israel? Where are they?
You can tell he's not a bird watcher.
Well, I know a lot of birds, buzzards in Israel.
Well, some of them can fly, and some of them can't.
Let's talk about the real ones.
I am a little bit torn when I have to answer a question like this, because I always say, well, do the people really want to know the facts, or do they want to hear what they want to hear? I know that your policy here is to stick with the facts as closely as possible, and that's why if I had not known that, I wouldn't have accepted your invitation to come. But today, we have a lot of gee-whizism, and a lot of people that are trying to pin the donkey's tail on everything that passes by. And I think this is the illustration of it. There has been many, many reports that there's hundreds of thousands of buzzards in the Valley of Megiddo. Well, that is not true. That is not true. On the other hand, it is true that there is an increase in the number of vultures in Israel. The Hebrew word for that's used there can be applied to any big bird of prey or a bird of carrion. So if you take that word in Hebrew, you have to get all the crows and all the magpies and all the, any bird that would eat flesh, hawks, eagles, anything that would eat carrion. So that would be quite, for the word itself, in what it means. So if we take that word, Nesharim, and apply it to all the birds that occur in that family, all the eagles and all the crows and all the birds that eat flesh, there has been a tremendous increase in the count of those birds in that land. But why has there been an increase? Since the turn of the century, at the turn of the century, Haifa was at the edge of the desert. And everything south of Haifa was desert. There was no tree, there was no crops, there were no farms. Everything was desert. As the Jewish people began to come back, they began to drain the swamps in the Jezreel Valley and the Hula Valley. They began to carry away the rocks to irrigate the land where they could. And very slowly, the flora of the land began to increase. Now, when you have an increase of flora, you have an increase of plants that produce feed for birds. So the bird population as a whole began to increase.
Now, the latter rains have made this possible, too.
That's right, because the Bible prophesied, and here's something that man cannot control, and that's the weather, that since the turn of the century, every year, and especially since the creation of the Jewish state, there has been a phenomenal increase in rainfall, annual rainfall average in Israel. Each decade, it's amazing, 400 and 500% increase from one decade to the other. Now, there is a natural way to explain this, to say, well, because they are bringing in the trees, the forest, the vegetation, that creates a ecology where it makes for more rainfall. But we must realize, too, that it's raining in the desert where there are none of those trees and so forth at this time. But the desert has retreated all the way to Beersheba, and now they're going all the way down into the Negev, into the Sinai, and they're establishing kibbutzim, and you see these green farms all the way down.
Well, we were down as far south as Assad on the way to Sodom there, and you can see green vegetation, oats, barley being grown right out there in the middle of the desert.
That's true today, but you didn't see that 15 years ago. That's in the last 15 years. I remember when they started those desert projects, and David Ben-Gurion advocated to go to the desert, to Ein Bokeh, and those places in Ein Bokeh, the kibbutzim that were established down there where there was nothing. There was not a blade of anything. Now they have productive farms there. And the rainfall is increasing all the way down in that area. With the increase of rainfall, you have the increase of birds. With the increase of birds, the increase of animals. With the increase of wildlife, you have the increase of wildlife that dies or that is killed, and this causes an increase in the vultures and so forth that in nature's balance that take care of that. So there is a natural increase. We must remember that the Arabs killed, when they got guns for the last couple hundred years, they killed everything, the gazelle, the ibex, everything was killed off that would be competitive to the sheep having the grass, sheep and goats having the grass. So Israel has had to go back in and bring back these animals that have become distinct in the land.
And besides that, they brought goats in, which ate up all of the grass and created the desert.
That's right. Loudermilk said that the Arabs were called the fathers of the desert, but he said, indeed, they are the creators of the desert. He said, you could put them in a jungle, in a few years it would be a desert because of the way they graze it, and they do not, they're not attuned to the needs of ecology and to take care of the land.
And now Israel is actually introducing animals. This latest issue of Bible Archaeology tells of them even introducing the possibility of leopards in the Negev area.
That's right. There are 80 some leopards in the Judean desert alone. Now they have tagged 80 leopards that came on their own, and I had the misfortune of meeting one of those gentlemen in a cave in a very close confine. It did not take long to determine whose right it was to stay in that cave.
What happened?
Huh?
What happened?
I don't know. I didn't stay there to see.
Oh,
I evacuated.
Now, the explanation that you have given, I can readily accept because I saw many birds over there that look like crows. I don't know the name of the bird. And, like you said, storks. And although I didn't see, I may have seen a few buzzards off in the distance. But as you brought out, I'm sure the buzzard population is increasing naturally. And in any event, the prophecy there in Revelation will be fulfilled. Because God, whether they are birds that are native to the area at that time or not, God is going to bring them in.
He said he would call them in from the four winds of the heaven.
And you take the scent of rotting flesh is carried on the wind for hundreds of miles. So all the bird population from that entire area, the flesh-eating birds, is going to be brought in. As you were talking there too, I was thinking about what the scripture says, that when the Jew is in the land blossoms like a rose. When the Jew is out of the land, it has become desert. That has always applied. You know, when the Jews came back from the Babylonian captivity, even in 70 years, the land had become non-productive and desert. The Jews set his foot back in the land. It began to rain more, the former rain, the latter rain. We read there, I believe it's in Amos, that in the last days, the planter will overtake the reaper the sower the harvester. And you can go from Ashdod down to Jerusalem, down, even down into the Negev. You can see that happening. In one field, you will see men planting, men plowing, and men and women reaping, or getting the harvest.
That's true.
This has never happened before.
That's true. They're growing seven crops a year on the same piece of land.
Now, the prophecy said this would come to pass in the days that the Messiah would come.
That's right. In Israel's third commonwealth. And right. We're there.
We sure are.
And it's, you know, it's so wonderful to see all these prophecies that are not world-shaking events, but Israel shall blossom and bud and fill the face of the earth with fruit. And today, Israel exports more vegetables to Europe than Europe produces. All the Arab countries are totally, almost totally dependent, not altogether, but almost totally dependent on Israel for their produce. Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Syria, Iraq, even Iran uses oranges from Israel and fruits from Israel.
I'm sure you've been there at the Allenby Bridge, and you can see Arab trucks from all over, probably some even going to Syria. And at the time, the government of those nations are denouncing Israel and threatening to destroy Jerusalem. Their trucks are lined up with produce at the Allenby Bridge to go to Syria, to go over to Jordan, and to go down in Saudi Arabia.
My friend, business is business, you know, and you live over there. You hear all this verbal war going on the surface, but when you get over there and live, you find out that there's the international banking and all that goes right along between Israel and Jordan and Syria and these countries. Politically, they're angry, but these countries are depending on Israel.
After all, they've got to eat.
That's right, and business is business.
Now that's startling that a little.
Did you know that Alia Airlines is now serving kosher meals to entice Jewish groups to fly Aliyah to Jordan and to Israel? Now, who would have believed that 10 years ago?
Huh? Oh, amazing, amazing.
Business is business, right?
I was thinking that Israel is such a small nation. How big is it?
Oh.
About the size of New Jersey?
Oh, well, let's say this way, that Israel is by car 2 hours wide and 6 hours long, but it's 5,741 years deep. You get my connotation.
Yes.
The history of Israel is larger than the whole world.
You know, I when I was in Iraq, I looked at that huge valley there, the Euphrates Valley between the Tigris and the Euphrates, and we went up and down from Ur up to Nineveh, and you see the vast amount of rich land there, and you think, boy, if the Jews had that land, they could feed the world, and they could. And there in Israel today, you know, you go from Haifa on down to Jerusalem, and you pass into the West Bank. Now, I know you hear a lot of propaganda today about the West Bank.
That's Judea and Samaria.
But actually, that is the territory that Jordan held. Now, are you in agreement that the West Bank couldn't feed a herd of goats, for the most part?
The amazing thing, I have some friends who live in the West Bank, Arab friends, who in 1967, when Israel took over, it was in the spring of the year, you know, and they were harvesting their wheat, and they were making about 40 bushels to the acre in wheat over, they jumped to over 110, 120 bushels per acre. And all the Arabs, you know, they said it's good for the Jews to walk on the ground because God blesses the ground. Even the Arabs said this. And that was their attitude, that because the Jews were back, now their land was going to bloom like Israel had bloomed. And we've seen it happen. In the West Bank today, you see, it's no comparison to what it was 15 years ago. It was truly a desert right up to the Israeli border. But where the Israel border started, there would be forest and trees and gardens and crops. Where Jordan had occupied the land, it was still a desolate desert.
Well, you can go there today, even today, and see the line between the land that Jordan had and the land that Israel has had. And my goodness, there is no comparison.
Yeah, those areas are deliberately not being reforested so that you can continue to see the difference.
Yes.
And
when we were in Cairo, I know our guide, who is an Arab, by the way, Muslim, that was in 79, and I gave her a book because I thought she would be interested in it, on that we published. Here, we on the Great Pyramid. And when Dr. Weber, David was there this past summer, she had used that book for a whole year and had it wrapped in tin's foil, and she used it in witnessing or in talking to the people that she led on tour. And she told me that secretly the Muslims and the Arabs were all glad secretly because the Jew was back in the land, because they believed that the economy of the whole area would be bettered by the Jew being back in the land. So regardless of the political propaganda, many Muslims and Arabs are secretly glad that the Jew is back in the land today.
Yeah, it depends on who they're talking to, you know,
right,
and how well they know you.
Right.
It's, you know, this thing that goes back so far, it's since the birth of Ishmael and Isaac, this thing has been going on. And we've got to separate. The Egyptians are not Arabs.
No.
The Syrians and Lebanese are not Arabs. The Jordanians do not consider themselves Arabs. I mean, when they're talking and living among themselves, each one has their own tribal identity. And the Palestinian, so-called Palestinians, are the Ishmaelites. And they're the ones that have always caused the trouble. Before the Jews came back, they caused trouble between the other countries there, like the Moabites and Ammonites and the Egyptians, which are African. They kept all the trouble going there. So to the people who live there, they accept this as a part of the nature of the situation. And the people themselves, for example, there are people in Jordan who are not Palestinians, who are very pro-Israel. You know?
Oh, yes. Yes. You go over there and talk to people, it's an amazing paradox. Dr. Garrett, do you have something to ask Brother Jones about?
Yes, I was anxious to get back to the buzzards. You were saying that actually Israel is in such a geographical position that it is on these bird runs from Europe, from Asia, down into Africa, and then, of course, in the spring, they go back up again over Israel. That means they drop seed from these various sections.
That's right.
They land there, and they feed there, and all this kind of thing. So the whole thing is growing in that respect.
That's right. With the bird migration route going up the Syro-African Rift, that begins at Mount Hermon and goes all the way to Entebbe. That's interesting, isn't it? But this Syro-African Rift that goes all the way through, this is the migration route of the birds that both for Europe, Asia, and Africa all go right through that country. Israel to Israel, but only to Africa, or plants that are natural to Europe and not to the Middle East or Africa. So they've got, Israel has over 200 climatic conditions, and so they can grow anything that can be grown anywhere on the earth can be grown in Israel.
Now, you like to go there in the spring.
I do.
Why?
When I take groups over, and I usually go with pastors and so forth. I'm not a tour guide, I'm not a tourist operator, but I have a ministry of this, and I go 3 or 4 times a year. And I like to go in the spring of the year because it's like the Garden of Eden. In April, the orange blooms begin to blossom, and the whole country smells like a perfume plant.
So the desert really blossoms here.
That's right. And what in January, February, or in June, July, and August is going to be barren, desolate hills are all covered with poppies and a kaleidoscope of colors. It's just breathtaking.
What about this big flower you were telling us about?
Oh, I don't know what it was, but in down by the Dead Sea, where I'm excavating in the cave down there, you can see these big flowers. I don't know what they were. They were big white flowers, beautiful, all over the place. I'd never seen them because last year, again, we had a very high rainfall during the winter. And it was just amazing, the production of that desert where you would think nothing ever grew, turned like the Garden of Eden. Poppies, the hills covered with poppies as far as you could see. And then just every kind of plant growing. So that's the reason I like to take people in the spring.
This is very exciting to realize that nature itself seems to be born again in that area with the coming back of the Jew, just as it's been prophesied in the Word of God.
God is the God of nature.
And all of this is working together today, just as the prophecy has revealed itself. We're very grateful for your being here, and we're going to continue our discussion in our next broadcast.
Until the next broadcast, God bless you, each and every one. God is still on the throne, and prayer changes things. I'm glad to greet you in the lovely name of our God and Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ. Here once again, Reverend Wendell Jones, for the roundtable discussion today.
This is Emil Gaverluck with Noah Hutchings, and we are interviewing Wendell Jones, a unique gentleman who is a student of Hebrew and who lives in America and who also lives in Israel, and he has some rather amazing things to talk to us about. The natural geology of Israel is such that it gives it a variety of climate that I don't think any other nation in the world has.
That's true, because due to the radical change in the topography, beginning at sea level up to the mountains and down to the Dead Sea, which is in the Syro-African Rift, over 1,000 feet below sea level, we find that it gives Israel over 200 different climatic conditions. And in that, you have a great variety of possible produce and things of that nature.
Now, the Dead Sea is in this rift.
That's right.
How many feet is it below sea level, below Mediterranean sea level?
The mean level of the Dead Sea is almost 1,400 feet, 1,396 feet at the surface. Now, you've got to understand that in the north end, it's another 1,400 feet to the bottom of it. It's that
deep.
It's as deep farther down from the surface as it is below sea level.
You go swimming in the north end or in the south end, and you can't ever get to the bottom because you just float up at the top. You can even read a newspaper.
That's right. It's even difficult to put enough weight on to scuba dive. And if you do, the water is so heavy that you cannot endure the depths that you can endure in.
Now, what causes that? The fact is the Dead Sea does not have an outlet.
It does not have an outlet, and the accumulation of minerals in the water, the minerals natural level is 26%.
This is the Jordan River that dumps all its water into the Dead Sea.
Yes, plus the salt and the things that come up from beneath, from the geothermal effect of the bottom. It's very hot on the bottom of the sea because of the geothermal presence of geothermal heat in that area. And on the bottom, it's just like gravy. And there's a lot of asphalt. It's a very thick material. And of course, the best thing to do in their desalination for getting minerals would be to get that water from the bottom. But it's so heavy.